Welcome back to the SI Media Podcast. This is our third show. First show, Rachel Nichols and Adam Schefter. Second show was Vern Lundquist. And today, we are excited to have Rebecca Lowe, the host of NBC Sports' Premier League coverage. She does Premier League Live, the pre- and post-match shows. She's really, really terrific on that. I'm Richard Deitch, by the way, my producer, as always. It's the great Bette Marston. Rebecca Lowe, if you are a soccer fan, and you probably are if you're listening to this, you know just how high quality she is when it comes to her work. She joined NBC Sports in 2013, relocated here from England, where she was the host of ESPN's UK coverage of the Premier League. Prior to that, she was a presenter and a reporter for Satania Sports. She worked at the BBC. She's of really interesting lineage in that her father, John Lowe, was a really well-known BBC News presenter for 37 years. So she was raised in journalism and broadcasting in Britain and has just become, you know, arguably one of the best studio hosts now in this country. You saw her at the Olympics. She did a sensational job. I'm a great admirer of her work, so I was really psyched that she agreed to be one of our early podcast guests. As I've said on every previous podcast and probably will again, Bette Marston loves short intros, so I will kill it now as we go to Rebecca Lowe of NBC Sports. Okay, as promised, here is Rebecca Lowe. Rebecca, first of all, thank you very much for joining the podcast. My first question for you is, do you prefer broadcaster, presenter, or something else?
Oh, that's an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that before, Richard. I would probably, that's a hard one to start with. I'm going to go with broadcaster because I think it encompasses everything. Presenter, which we use in the UK, is solely, solely a television presenter, I would say. So because I do kind of contribute to things on the radio and podcasts and things, I would say broadcaster is a more of an umbrella term. So yeah, but both are good.
You know, it's interesting to me, and when I knew you were going to come on, I wanted to ask you this, and I realized this is sort of a technical question, but do you see any – is the word presenter pejorative at all in that it doesn't connotate, let's say, someone who thinks away from the teleprompter or someone who is in the process or, you know, creates the process of journalism? Or am I looking at it maybe from a very American viewpoint where if I hear the word presenter, I almost think of an actor or an actress?
Yeah, I think that's a very American way of looking at it, Richard. I think, and that's purely because we just use a very different word. So I say presenter, and that to me is a host or an anchor. So in the UK, it's funny. This is the whole language thing is so interesting because in the UK, if I'm hosting a corporate event, I would be the host. I wouldn't be the presenter. Presenter really only means on screen or on the radio, and whether you have a prompter or not is nothing really to do with it. But a news presenter and maybe an entertainment presenter, they all come under the same thing, whether you have a prompter or not. So yeah, it's kind of a strange one, but it's mainly to do with the American English different use of the word. So I would say I'm an anchor, host, or presenter, depending which of you're using, American or English.
That's interesting. All right, Rebecca, let's see how American you've become. Did you watch the season finale of Mad Men?
Do you know what? I've never even seen one episode of Mad Men, so no, I definitely didn't see the finale. But I do watch Scandal, so I'm very American where that comes in.
All right, so you watch Scandal, but not Mad Men. Do you have a favorite character on Scandal? Whether it's Fitz, Jake, Olivia?
No, it's got to be Olivia Pope. She's just legendary. I love her.
She is good. I like, I like Command. I like Joe Morton,
no,
the actor.
No, they're the baddies. No, I like her, and I like Abby. I like her old assistant who now works at the White House.
Correct, White House. All right, so you really have become American, Rebecca. You can talk Scandal.
Basically, yeah.
I appreciate that. All right, so let's, as we head to what you do for a living, your job is very unique in American sports television. In given the amount of hours that you are on the air and the tonnage of coverage that NBC has when it comes to the EPL, I think this would be interesting. And there's going to be a lot of soccer fans who listen to this. Can you take listeners through your preparation each week and be as specific as possible? Because you really have to dial down on every team in that league.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so the overall through each week of the season, and I would probably say in the summer months as well, every moment I'm at home when I'm not doing something specific, whether I'm not doing prep or I'm not watching Scandal, I have British radio on. So I have, through my phone, I have an app for TalkSport Radio in the UK and for BBC Radio 5 Live. TalkSport is 24/7 football, really, and Radio 5 Live is a little bit more of a mix. So I tune into that the whole time. I also subscribe to the Daily Telegraph and the Times newspapers. So every morning on my iPad, or actually, to be honest, sometimes the night before, because of the time difference, Richard, I can go to bed at 11 p.m. and I can read the Daily Telegraph from the next morning that's already come out, obviously in the UK, which is quite nice, actually, going to bed knowing what tomorrow's stories are. So every day of my life, I read both of those newspapers, sports sections, and I listen to Talk Sport or 5 Live. So if I wasn't on the phone to you now and I was pottering around the house, I would have the radio on. And in the UK, I used to do the same, but I used to have Sky Sports News on, which is a rolling 24 hours sports channel over there. So it's just a bit different. I can't get that over here, so I have to get the radio, which is fine. And some of the things I listen to, I don't need to listen to them, but when you have it on all the time, by osmosis, it's not information I'm learning, it's really more angles. And what I like is my brain seems to soak up these topics, these debates that they have on the radio, and then coupled with reading the newspapers as well and some other blogs and other interesting websites, come the weekend, I really have formulated the angles I think we should be attacking. So that's what I do all year round. And then for each week, let's say my week starts on a, let's say it starts on a Thursday. I have a Thursday conference call every Thursday at lunchtime for between an hour and 2 hours. And that's with the studio guys, with my producers. And then we do about an hour reviewing the weekend shows that we've done 4 days ago. So we go through almost line by line, segment by segment, and we are critiqued, both good and bad. You know, we've said that really worked, or maybe that didn't work so well, how can we do it better? And we go through Saturday show, Sunday show, and Monday show, the entire thing. So Pierre, my boss, and one of the other producers, Adam, will have watched all of the shows back, and they will have created a document with all of the comments. So we'll all go through it as a team and discuss, you know, why did we do it that way? Why didn't we do it that way? But also, gosh, that actually going to break using that shot was great because of this, 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 and this. So we really review the weekend. Then after that, the guys from the UK, so Arlo White plus Lee and Graham, will get on the call, and we'll all have a massive group discussion of the fixtures that are coming up that weekend for a good half an hour to an hour, usually based around the fixtures that we are, where the guys are going. So the game on the Saturday and the game on the Sunday where Arlo and that lot are going, we'll focus around those and get everyone's point of view. And it's everybody, it's Kyle, Robbie, and the guys in the UK, and we'll all talk football, really, and the big storylines and what we're going to hit that weekend. Then Thursday afternoon, I'll tend to just spend doing some more reading and constantly looking at, you know, social media and find out what's going on and listen to the radio. Friday comes, I spend the whole day prepping. So I have a system where I'm usually up at 6, and I like to get a lot of prep done in before we have another conference call at 9. That's really to go through the format of the show. And then I spend and that's about an hour. Then I spend the rest of the day, I write a little bit of scripts, but to be honest, Richard, there isn't a lot you can write because, as you know, our show, after the pregame at 7 a.m., there's nothing else that we're going to know what's going to happen. So I might write my hello and welcome. I might write, that's about it, really. I occasionally might write the table if it's quite a complicated top half of the table or bottom half of the table. But other than that, there's nothing to write. So I'll just, what I do, though, is I transcribe off the software that NBC use is still very different from what I've been used to in the UK. And it's very difficult still for me, I find, to read the way an American format is. So I kind of make my own format, and that takes me a few hours. And then once I've done that, I handwrite that. It's about 10 pages long, depending on the length of the show. After I've done that, I then look at the research packet that the guys have given us, and often that's about 10 pages long for each game. I then transcribe, make my own notes for each game as well. I look at the BBC Sport website. I look at some of the newspapers as well, and I get down what I think are both the key stats and key storylines for every single game. And then I'm usually done by about 3 o'clock on a Friday, and then I try and relax for a couple of hours, listen to the radio, and then I'm in bed at 7, which is quite crazy, especially in the summer when it's light outside. I go to bed at 7 because I have no choice. I have to go to bed at 7 because my alarm goes off at 3:25. And as you can tell from my timings, I'm very specific. So 3:25 works perfectly because I get picked up at 4, and I'm in the studio by 4:25 into makeup, and then the guys come in at about 5, and in the makeup room we discuss our opening thoughts for the opening chat, and we have a debate about what we need to talk about and what we're going to hit for that 3-4 minute chat. And then I'm in rehearsal at 6 and on air at 7. And then I come back up from work on a Saturday, usually after we've taped Match of the Day. I'm home by about 5. And I go straight to my office and I do the whole thing again for Sunday's show. And then I go to bed half an hour later because I have to get up half an hour later. So I'm in bed at 7:30 on a Saturday night. I'm very cool. As you can tell, my husband loves this. He's loving his weekends. I'm never there. And then in bed at 7:30 on Saturday, up at this, and at half an hour later Sunday morning, and then do the whole of Sunday. And I give myself Sunday night off. I'm usually home by about 4. And then Monday show, I do all Monday morning. And then Tuesday, I try to have off. Wednesday, we have a conference call, I think. And then back to Thursday again. So that's kind of the week.
That's interesting. Very regimented schedule, which is interesting.
I am a very regimented person, Richard. I would never veer. Once I have a system, and I've created a system, which was a big part of coming to the U.S., and I explained to Pierre, I said, I need to know exactly when I'm needed and at what times, because I'm a creature of routine, and I like, once I've got my system and it works, I won't veer from it.
So when the EPL season ends, can you take a vacation somewhere, or are you actually, is it troubling for you to have so much free time where there really is no schedule?
Yeah, a bit of both. The first couple of weeks are not troubling. The first couple of weeks are usually I sort of have a big come down, and I would say in about, I've been doing football now for, I guess, my whole career, so 12, 13 years, and at the end of every season I usually get sick. I mean, uh-huh. I normally write off the 2 weeks at the end of the season. Last season it happened, season before it happened. I think it's partly your body. It is in such a regime, and me especially with the hours I do, that it just kind of, it comes to an end. My brain can switch off on Sunday night, for example, this Sunday night, and then after that, my body just goes with it. So I usually get sick for a few days, and then we'll definitely go on vacation, and we'll do, and have a nice, good, long breakaway. And when I get back after about a month or so of being off, just slowly but surely, my brain starts to say, okay, I'm done now with my rest, so when are we starting again? And I'm just that kind of person. I always look ahead, I always look forward, and I don't like too much time off, but I definitely need it because it's a long old season, Richard.
One of the interesting things, obviously, about your job, when you're giving highlights of so many different games, you have to really be facile, just given all the cuts and stuff. You mentioned Pierre. That's Pierre Moussa. He's the point person for NBC's EPL coverage. Is he the person, Rebecca, who's in your ear? And can you give us some insight into what that dynamic is? When you have two people on screen you have to converse with. You have a producer likely in your ear telling you maybe where you're going next. And then you obviously visually have to know what the viewer at home is seeing because you're the direct link to the viewer.
Yeah, yeah. And again, interestingly, Richard, this is new to me because in the UK we do it in a different way. So in the UK, let's say I was doing my show for NBC but over in the UK, I would have Robbie and Kyle, say, with me. And then in my ear, I would have three voices. I would have the producer, who is the editorial voice. I'd have the director telling me which camera I need to be looking at and what graphic is coming next. And then I'd have what they call a PA, a program assistant, who does all the timings. So when I first got to, and so I'd have total open talk back. So anything that those people said to anybody else, I could also hear. So that's what I've been used to at the BBC, at Setanta Sports, and at ESPN over there. I come to NBC, and like they do it on every American network here, it's not that way. You just have one voice, and it's closed. So I have, I have silence in my ear until Pierre wants to talk to me, and then he comes. So that's very different from what I've been used to. I found that took a while to get used to because I don't like silence in my ear. It's not something I've grown up with. I don't like that. It feels like I'm left by myself. And on TV, you never ever want to have that feeling that your talk back has gone down because you don't know where you're going. And that's not a nice feeling. So it took me a while to trust that my talk back hadn't gone down. It was just that you guys do it differently. So yes, Pierre is the one in my ear. So he gives me my timings. He gives me a camera if I need to know which camera I'm looking at. And he tells me what's coming up next. The editorial side of things is something that him and I discuss during breaks. It's obviously very difficult to discuss it while we can't discuss it while we're on air, but on the whole, I just take my own lead from that, and then during the break, I might say to him, I think we should do this, or he says, I think we should do that. And it's a discipline that a producer/director has to have with a presenter that you learn. you both learn through the years. So Pierre will only talk to me when they're talking. So if we're doing highlight reel and Kyle is talking us through a goal, Pierre will know that Kyle tends to talk for 20 to 25 seconds. So if he needs to tell me something, that we're going to a Louis van Gaal interview next, which wasn't planned, he will tell me in that bit. But of course, he knows that he can't talk to me for too long in my ear, because I've got to hear what Kyle says, and I've got to be ready to come in and once Kyle finishes talking. And sometimes Kyle might make a joke. And if I don't react to that joke, it's weird and it looks like I'm not listening. And that is the biggest, in my eyes, the most fundamental mistake that I always try not to make, is not listening. Because it's the hardest thing to do in some ways, is to listen while you've got all these other things going on. But my dad always used to tell me when I was a kid and growing up, you know, if you ever get into this world, when you're interviewing somebody, when you're on a show, you have to listen to the people who are on the show with you or the person you're interviewing, because you'll miss a trick and it'll come across terribly to the viewer, because they'll be thinking, well, if she's not listening, why should I? So it's an interesting dynamic, and one that is it's a very difficult one to get right, but I think we get it, you know, pretty much right, you know, most of the time. It's an interesting one.
Well, and we'll get to your dad in a second, who I mentioned at the top worked for the BBC for 37 years, very well known in England as a presenter. But that what's interesting to me is, Rebecca, and you know, you've now worked, you've done the Olympics for NBC, and you've obviously worked with a lot of American broadcasters. Do you think the idea of that many people in someone's ear would be, because it strikes me, having interviewed many, many American broadcasters, just how difficult that, you know, if you did the reversed, just how difficult that would be for them if they were doing on-air work in England.
Absolutely. I remember Bob Lee, when I came over and worked for ESPN for the Women's World Cup and the Euros in 2011 and 2012, I remember I was explaining it to Bob Lee, and he said, no, hang on, how many people do you have in your ear? And I said, but that's normal, Bob. And I think it's all about, you know, human beings just, you know, they adapt to whatever they are given, and I've never known anything else, Richard. But yes, I think it would be easier for me. I think it's easier for a UK person to adapt to cutting it down to one person than it would be for maybe an American to go to the UK. I think that would be really, really trying and very confusing for them, because what you have to learn to do in England is filter out when they're not talking to you. So I can hear my producer saying, well, I don't want that graphic. Or I remember when I was at the BBC, I was live on air doing a sports bulletin, and I could hear the guy in my ear ordering a pizza. and I'm trying to give the sports news. So you have to learn to filter it out. And I think that can only come if you start that age 21. You can't expect somebody to go to the UK aged, you know, 45 or 50, who've been doing it for 20 years, and suddenly deal with three different people in your ear. It's very, very difficult.
Nice. I love that. I love the idea of somebody ordering pizza while the person on air is hearing
it. I know.
Crystal Palace is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is going to finish either 11th, 12th, or 13th in the table?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, it's amazing.
All right, right. I mean, all right. You are a very public supporter of this team. And this is interesting to me, because this is a very, and I know you've probably addressed this, but this is an interesting kind of difference between, I think, broadcasters in the UK and in the US, as well as its own soccer dynamic. So in the UK, I think being a presenter and openly a fan of a certain team is very common. There are so many ex-players in particular who are on air, and they know they're associated with Arsenal or Manchester United or Chelsea or whoever. In the States, and especially in NBC Sports, you know, management, producers will always tell you, do not outwardly root for teams, do not outwardly root for the Americans at the Olympics. So I wonder for you, how do you sort of dance along this interesting line of, you're a well-known Crystal Palace supporter, but you probably, because it's the States, can't be so over the top, because our tradition of broadcasting, generally speaking, frowns on people who are outwardly, you know, sort of rooting for a team on air.
I think it's a very interesting dynamic. I think in the UK, I wouldn't say it's as kind of open as that. When I was in the UK, I never once, I don't know if I ever gave an interview about Crystal Palace. Somebody may have once mentioned it, or seen me at a game and then everyone knew, or something. It wasn't like, oh, everyone knows Rebecca's a Crystal Palace fan. I don't think you would look at many presenters on television and know who they supported. There's one or two you might, and yes, is it frowned upon? Less so, maybe. Less so, like you say, than it is in the US. Over here, I'd like to think that I don't outwardly root for Crystal Palace at all on air. It's something that I take a very, very seriously. I'm lucky in a way because we don't often win, so there's not always a lot of, you know, I mean, the last couple of seasons have been a little different, but we don't, you know, it's not often that we're doing a Palace game because we're not one of the biggest clubs. So I guess I'm lucky that I'm not a Manchester United supporter because that would be different. And I think it's, again, it's easier for me to be a Crystal Palace fan because I'm not one of the big clubs, so it's not like everyone's going to hate me because I'm a Chelsea fan and winning everything. So it's not like that. So that makes it a bit easier. I don't ever, and I think I can say, I've definitely never in 2 years mentioned anything to do with my, you know, who I support on air, and I never would. The Men in Blazers, who I went and did yesterday for their end of season finale show, they mention it all the time. And, you know, that's the kind of, you know, the kind of show that they do and the kind of humour that they use. And that's kind of me, almost me out of work anyway. But I never bring it up unless I'm asked about it. But it's difficult because, and I don't know why it's different, Richard, but in the UK, similarly over here, I'm sure, it's very much ingrained in who you are since a young age. And so I can't change it and I can't lie about it. It's just who I am and who I support and that's it. But I take great pride. And even in the UK, I was sent to do a lot of Crystal Palace features, interviews, match reports, and I would never dream of talking about them as my club in a million years. So, you know, whilst it's out there and it's come out, it's not something that I try to talk about unless I'm asked about it.
That's interesting. You mentioned Men in Blazers. You know, I'm a huge admirer of what they do. I think they're unique and really interesting, very, very smart guys. They do they still refer to you as Mother of Dragons, or have they moved on from that?
No idea. They seem to have different names for me every week, but I know that one, but I can't remember which show it comes from.
Game of Thrones, so that you're not watching that as well.
No, I'm not watching that.
You're not getting a job at HBO. You're not getting a job at HBO, Rebecca, with this kind of attitude.
I know.
All right, so, but you enjoy being on that show, right? It seems like whenever you're on, you are carrying those two, so your back must hurt.
No, it is, I love being on the show. It's great fun. It's obviously very different from how our show is.
Right.
And I think the two complement each other. We, you know, we have fun on our show, but football is a serious game to a lot of people. So that's our kind of attitude towards it. And those guys have so much fun, and it's always a joy to be on there. And of course, Michael Davis and I go back. Well, we didn't realize quite how far we went back because we both went to the same high school in Pennsylvania for a year.
Right.
He went in the 80s, may I just add. I went in the very late 90s. Yeah, we both are alumni from that boarding school, bizarrely. So, and now here we are on the same channel. So there's a nice link there as well. And they're really great guys doing great jobs.
Let me ask you one question about the Olympics, because when I've spoken to you in the past, I think that working for NBC at the Olympics left a significant impression on you in terms of just doing another sport, hosting such a mega event. Why was that experience for you, at least in broadcasting, so fulfilling? And it would seem to me that you must have, especially if you stay with NBC, you must have interest heading forward in working at future Olympics.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, going to Sochi last year really opened my eyes to the Olympics and what it can bring to a viewer and what it can bring to people who are lucky enough to work on it, Richard. I mean, I think one of the things I took away from Sochi, that maybe the biggest thing, was the access. You know, I come from a world where you can't get near footballers and managers and people at the top of their game. And with the Winter Olympics, to get the guys coming in the studio, the skaters, the skiers, the bobsledders, whoever they were, they came in, and to know their story and for them to want to tell you their story, for me, was like nothing I'd ever experienced before, because I have spent my entire career trying to get a story out of people, and they just don't want to give it, because in the UK, Premier League footballers, and actually, to be honest, all footballers and many sportsmen have a wall up all the time, and the access is very difficult to get to. And if you do get a story out of them, the press officer often says, can you not run it, because we're not really sure if he'll want you to run it, because it's a story, you know. And when I talk about story, I don't mean a salacious headline. I mean a nice little nugget, you know, something from his childhood.
Right.
There's a real fear in the UK and where I'm from of what the media are trying to do. And on the whole, 90% of the media are just trying to tell a story. That's what we're trying to do. And the Olympics is the ultimate for storytelling, with storytellers, the athletes, being so open to us. And that is what was so fulfilling. I could learn about these people, tell their story, and see them achieve the ultimate. And you can't get that in anything else, Richard.
Have you, Rebecca, have you been told by your bosses that you are already on the Rio team?
No, not in so many words, no. I mean, it's a good question, actually. No, I think my contract is inclusive of it, but I don't know any further details.
All right, I'll get Mark Lazarus on the horn and demand that you're there. You once told me that one day, and you were being truthful about this, you would like to host a baking show in your career. Is that still correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, and baking is specific, and anyone who's listening to this from my show will laugh their heads off because, basically, Richard, I have always loved baking, ever since I was a kid, and cooking. But baking was always something I loved, and I'm not particularly good at it. And now I've sort of transformed into a baker who bakes without things like sugar and refined flour. So when I bake things, they don't always turn out brilliantly, but I do bring them in to the show. So the guys on a Saturday at 10 a.m., once the second game of the day has kicked off, out comes my baking goods, my baked goods. And then they're usually rated by Carl, Robbie, and graded. Now, what you have to understand is that Robbie Musto's wife, Cassie, probably would win every baking competition the world over. So I have major competition, but Cassie uses sugar, you see. She uses all those things. So she creates beautiful things, and here I am trying to get them to eat, and no sugar, no fat, no flour, blueberry muffin that quite often ends up in the trash. But, you know, I try, and God loves a trier, and I do love baking. So, but to be serious, I would one day, yes, I'd love to just host a show where it was a bit more hands-on and a bit less about something that's about to happen. A bit, how do I explain it? Just something different. I would just love to one day do something different. Absolutely. And baking is a passion of mine. So who knows? Who knows?
Do you have a particular baked good that you feel like, you know, for you right now, this is the messy of your baking?
With or without sugar?
Let's say without sugar, because I think that's much harder.
Oh, it's tough. They're very, very tough. I wouldn't say I've got a lot to go on, but from my experience, I would say that I can do a fairly decent banana and walnut loaf without sugar and without flour. It's a little dense, if I'm honest, Richard, but it's not bad.
All right, So we'll keep that. We'll think of that down the road. I'm correct about this. Your contract with NBC covers the length of the Premier League rights agreement. So as you're thinking about heading forward in broadcasting in the States, how important? I feel like I've asked you this question sort of in different ways, but do you have to stay? Or is it your intention to stay with wherever the Premier League goes? Or could you conceivably work for a network that does not have the EPL?
I think so much is dependent on the coming months. And I think that the first thing to say is that NBC is far and away the best company I've ever worked for. And I have worked for a few, like I said, the BBC, Satanta Sports, and ESPN UK. NBC is just... It's like a company that I actually hoped I'd work for one day and never thought I would. The way it treats its employees, the ethic it has within the company, the way that they go about things, the philosophy behind things, the teamwork, the general nice feel when you walk in that building. I love it. I absolutely love it. So first and foremost, I love where I work. And I hope to goodness I can work there for a long, long time. But my job, by its very nature, is a 3-year cycle if I do stay within football, as you say. And I have to be prepared that one day that might change. And I don't necessarily want it to change, but it might have to change with the way that the world works. So, to be honest, to answer your question, I don't know. I love this country and I love NBC and I hope that things can carry on. But I have to always brace myself and brace my family and know that things changed. 3 years ago, if you told me I was going to be in the States, I wouldn't have believed you. So things do change, and as long as you're open to that, and I'm fine with change. Change is fine. I wouldn't be here if I wasn't okay with change. I'm open to anything, but I'm super happy, and this has been the best 2 years of my career by so far, I can't even tell you.
Have you, as a newfound person to the States, are you comfortable now with our American tax code? Is that working out for you?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Can we not even discuss the tax situation?
Because as someone who switched over here from the UK, I can only imagine how tough that must have been.
I mean, you know, I spend my life doing tax because the UK tax year and the US tax year are different. So my entire year is spent just dealing with an accountant either in the UK or in the US. But I'm kind of getting there. But it just amazes me that everyone has to do a tax return in the U.S., like every single person. In the U.K., you only do one if you're self-employed, which I've done for the last 10 years. So now I'm doing two. I mean, it's just, yeah, I'm getting there, I guess.
The land of the free, home of the brave, baby. All right, so here, Rebecca, we're going to play a quick game here. I need you to pick one of these choices. You can certainly tell us why, but you just have to pick one, okay?
Okay.
All right, so first one is, between these three, pick one and why. Rob Lowe, Chad Lowe, or Zach Lowe? You probably don't even know who Zach Lowe is. He's a writer for Grantland who writes basketball.
Chad Lowe?
Chad Lowe is Rob Lowe's, I believe, older, not as famous brother.
Okay, I'm gonna go Rob Lowe.
Okay, I can understand that. All right, do you go for a Plowman's lunch or a bento box?
A bento box.
Wow, that's surprising. All right, this might be the toughest one. Alexi Lalas or Taylor Twellman?
Oh, is there an extra? in what capacity? Like,
it's intentionally an open-ended question to embarrass you.
Oh, my God, neither. I'm going to go neither, and then they can just both get angry.
Yeah, I feel like that's – by the way, that is the correct answer, neither.
Okay, good.
Churchill or FDR?
Churchill.
Okay, I can understand that. Sean Connery, Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan, or Daniel Craig?
Oh, excellent question, Roger Moore.
Wow.
I
need to stop you on this because, you know, the de facto answer is always – Connery, and I can understand that, coolest Bond. There would be some people, I think, today who might say Daniel Craig, he's done a good job, but literally almost no one, unless they're, I would say, five wines in, would say Roger Moore. So what is the thought process on that?
Because, number one, I'm not the biggest James Bond fan in the world, but my brother, when we were kids, had one or two on an old video, and the only ones we had, and so every time it was his turn to choose the video, we had to watch it. And so I think when you watch something about 300 times, and I can't even remember, was it Live and Let Die? I can't remember.
Yeah, that's Live and Let Die is Roger Moore's first Bond film.
Live and Let Die. So we had Live and Let Die on loop in the late 1980s. And when you watch something so many times, you end up having an affiliation towards it. Now, it doesn't mean I think he's the best Bond, but he's the one, when you name those four, he's the one I gravitate to because of that.
All right, I like that answer. All right, and then finally, who's your favorite Harry Potter character and why?
Never read the book, never seen the film.
What? These are the first of all, horrible
I,
job.
I'm
my UK related questions are horrible, as Bet is looking at me with quite an evil eye incorrectly. All right, so you've never read the books and never seen that. Actually, not reading the books does not surprise me per se, but I can't believe you haven't seen one movie, flipping the channels.
Reasons. The reason I've never read the book is because when I was growing up, there was a very similar book called The Worst Witch, and I this is so boring to so many people, but to me, and I feel like when I've read a bit about Harry Potter, it's kind of like another version of that, and that was there before. So by principle, I won't read the book because I don't feel that it's as original as The Worst Witch. And then the film, I'm not really into movies or TV shows that can't happen in real life, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I don't really like fantastical kind of extra, I don't know, stuff like kids on broomsticks. I just don't like that kind of stuff. So I would never watch the movie, ever.
All right, it's interesting. All right, we got a couple more here for you. One thing that's really, your father's career was pretty remarkable in the amount of time he was working for the BBC, 37 years. And looking up his bio a little bit, he was in Northern Ireland, I believe, in the 80s. He's traveled as far as, like, Ethiopia. So when you were a young kid, what was it like to sort of see your father, not just on television, but to see him reporting from, I guess, as you learned, as you grew up and as an adult, were some pretty volatile places?
Well, you know what, Richard, it's interesting because the first thing growing up that I think, when I think of growing up and thinking about my dad, the first thing I feel is pride. Because I think when you're a kid and your dad does something that no one else's dad at school does, and when your dad comes to watch you play hockey or watch you play sport, and he's the dad is special and different in that way, just in that way, you know, that he does a job that's kind of like that. You, as a child, the feeling of pride I'd never experienced before. So, first of all, that is what the overriding feeling is from when I was a child. But don't forget, he used to do a lot of these reports into the evening news, and I'd be in bed. So I don't remember watching my dad reporting live from any of these volatile places. Maybe Argentina in the early 90s, but I'm not sure how volatile that particular journey was. It may have been, but I don't have a huge memory of watching him in any danger. I have a bigger memory of watching him in the studios in London and doing the news from that way. So I kind of was kept away from that side of things. And really only as I've got older have I sort of looked back and realised, wow, he certainly did go to some places. And like you say, Ethiopia as well. And I was, but I just think pride growing up was something that really ran through me in relation to my dad.
Has he, over the years, has he talked to you about the craft of broadcasting, especially when you were young and on the air in England?
Yes, a lot. I would say that ever since it's interesting because when I was growing up as a teenager, I wanted to be an actress. My mum was an actress, so I spent my entire teenage years, you know, performing to my mum and getting critiqued by my mum and never really needing my dad for that side of growing up because dad did something that I wasn't going to do. I was never interested in journalism. I majored in drama with an attempt to be an actress. So then when I changed career path, and I never ever became an actress, I went straight to the BBC out of university and I won this competition. And when I won it and got in at the BBC, that's when dad and I, my relationship changed as well, because suddenly I was entering his world. And I would say I spoke to him two or three or four times a week in the early days, and then after every single broadcast, I'd call him. And if he was in America right now, I'd probably do the same thing. Because of the time difference, I can't, because he's in bed by the time I come off there on the whole. But I speak to him on FaceTime every week, even now, and he always asks, how was the show? Tell me about the shows. And when he comes to visit, he comes for the whole day to the studio, and he sits there with a headset on. And, oh, it's making me emotional talking about it. But he sits there, and he listens to everything and goes through the whole day on the Saturday and the Sunday and often the Monday as well.
Oh, wow.
And any problem I've had in the last 12 or 13 years, I'd call him and say, what do I do? How do I deal with this? I'm fed up with this. I did this wrong. Should I be too worried? And he would see me through all of it because he's been there himself. And then, of course, it was so nice when he was coming up to retirement, Richard. I was at the BBC, and he was reading the news. He was the news anchor on the Rolling News channel on the BBC, and I was the sports anchor. And sometimes our shifts, for about 2 years, our shifts would collide. And so I would do the sport on the same set as him, and he would throw to me, and I'd do the sport. And, you know, that was a really special time, and I could throw back to him. And on my last day at the BBC before I left, I threw back to him and I called him Dad, which was really nice. And, I don't know whether the viewers knew it or not that we were father and daughter, but they did then, and I left anyway, the next day anyway. So that was really nice. That was one of the most special times in my life.
Yeah, that's great. What a great sounding board, Dad. Was your mother a stage or film actress?
She was mainly stage. She did some film and television as well. In the 70s and 80s, the theatre in the UK was really thriving in what they call repertory theatre, where she would go somewhere for the season and she would play, you know, in three different shows and they would just rotate it. And she was busy. She did a lot in the 70s and 80s. And then she gave it all up really to have my brother and I. So she then opened her own sort of presentation business, drama for the under five. So she's sort of always been in theatre. It's always sort of run through her.
Rebecca, at university, did you end up, because you were a drama major, did you do certain plays? I imagine you did, right?
Yeah, we did a lot of Shakespeare. Yeah, I did a lot of Midsummer Night's Dream. We did quite a few shows and plays that weren't very well known. We did a lot of, I can't even remember the playwrights, but we wrote a few ourselves. There's a lot of that. There was a lot of self-writing. They weren't very good, but we did a lot of those. On the whole, it was the course that I chose was too much theory, not enough practical. I would like to have gone to drama school where I wouldn't have had to have picked up a book. I could have just acted for 3 years, but my father was not particularly keen on sending me to drama school where I would leave without a degree, and it would also cost him an arm and a leg when he wasn't convinced that this was actually where I should be going. And I'm really, really glad that he won that particular debate, because my life would have been so different had I not gone to university and done what I did and met the people I did, which led me to applying to the BBC. So, I'm glad with that.
You know, if the Men in Blazers ever got a hold of your undergraduate kind of drama work, it could be unbelievable.
Not even a thought worth thinking.
All right, here are the final three. If you had to start a club team, Rebecca, let's eliminate. I'm going to eliminate Messi and Ronaldo from the choices because those are the obvious choices. I'm eliminating those two. Who is the first player in the world you would take if you were starting low FC?
Gareth Bale.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, why is that?
Because I'm not saying he's the best player after those two in the world, but he's the only player in my entire career when I've been to a game to work on and I've actually got out of my seat and I as a reporter, and I've seen, and I mean, I'm probably including all the games I've been to as a fan as well, but you won't get many Gareth Bales down Selhurst Park. Anyway, so he's the only, and to have the honour of interviewing him on many an occasion in that season where he was so brilliant for Spurs, he was just like the wind, and I've never seen anything like it on a pitch, so he would be mine.
Are you, even though it's on another network and you primarily do EPL and have done mostly men's soccer, how interested are you in watching the Women's World Cup coverage from Fox?
Really interested, Richard. I mean, lots of reasons. I've done women's football ever since I started at the BBC, right from the beginning. So I was the England reporter for years at the BBC, and then, of course, I did the Women's World Cup in 2011 over in Germany.
That's
with
right.
Bob Lee and the gang, and really involved myself for the whole month over there. Loved every single minute of it. We had a great time with ESPN and the guys, Brandy Chastain and Mia and Julie Fowley and all of the guys. So I know the setup, I know how it all works, and I know how exciting it can be and how you get so involved in it. I can't wait. I mean, England are going to be there, so it's going to really be a time for me to, it's something for me to enjoy, because I'm going to have time off, I can sit here and I can enjoy the Women's World Cup. It's going to be fantastic. And Fox look like they're really going for it. Just looking at the set that they're building looks phenomenal, so can't wait.
Yeah, gigantic set, and I just saw the TV schedule, and the tonnage is unbelievable. I mean, they're really treating this like an A-plus event, so that's great for fans of the sport.
It really is. It's fantastic. Can't wait.
You have answered this question for me before in print, but I'm going to ask it here because I know there are a lot of people on Twitter who asked me to ask you. Why are you not on Twitter?
It's a question which has many answers. Let me try and run through them. One is I was on Twitter 3 or 4 years ago, and I lasted about 3 months. And I decided it wasn't for me for a number of reasons. I think it's an excellent medium for news and breaking news and that sort of thing, and that is how I think it should be used. I'm not convinced that Twitter is being used now these days, Richard, in the way that it was supposed to be. I don't like the way that I do feel. I think life is very competitive. Generally, I'm a very competitive person. There are lots of things in life we compete at, and I think that some of it can be very healthy. I think that Twitter can lead to an unhealthy competition, whether it be followers, whether it be showing various parts of your life, whatever it is. I don't like it. It doesn't leave a nice taste in my mouth, witnessing that kind of openness and maybe that kind of competitiveness. I'm not always convinced that it brings out the best in people. And I think I'm a very private person, and we have a very private life, if you like. I like to come home, shut the front door, and live my life. I don't want to be coming home and people being able to access me in that way. I like to just go to work and do my job and love my job and give everything to my job, and then I like to come home and give everything to my husband and my family life. And that, to me, is something that I think can cross the line. And what I do for a living, it's very difficult. I know people can say, well, you should go on Twitter and just talk about football, and it's very difficult to do that. I think people will ask questions. I know friends who are on it, and they get asked questions all the time, and I don't ever want to be rude and not answer questions about my life, but at the same time, I don't necessarily want to answer every question about my life. And I just feel like it's a line that if you want privacy in your life and you value privacy in your life, and then you go on Twitter, it's very difficult then to not see a blurred line. So that's how I feel. I think it lets people down, or people let themselves down. At times it's dangerous. And I think I spend enough time on computers and iPads and phones. And, you know, I am on my phone a lot for various reasons. And then I look around, and so is everyone else. And I think sometimes that makes me sad. So I'm trying to limit being on my phone as much as I can. I'm not saying I don't use it for news and for work, because I do. Of course I do, because it's a very important medium, and I have to be across it. But it's not something that I'm comfortable with. And I sometimes, Richard, think, what is wrong with me? Everyone does it. Why is it that no one else feels this way? But I can't really answer your question any more than to say there's lots of reasons, and it's just not something that fits well with me or my life.
I think, first of all, I think that's a thoughtful answer, and I think there are more people who are like you than you realize. And I'm saying that as someone who's very, very active on Twitter. So I appreciate that answer, and I appreciate you answering it. And I don't think you're as alone as you might think in that thought process. All right, here's my final one for you, Rebecca. You've given us 45 minutes. I was going to try to take it to the hour, but we're going to let Men in Blazers have you for the full hour. We're going to do 45 minutes. All right, I want to ask you, and first of all, Alexi Lalas and Taylor Twellman are eliminated from your answer here, as I would expect them to be. But what person in or persons in sports broadcasting would you love to sort of sit down with and have dinner with and just pick their brain, who you have yet to do that with in the business?
Does it have to be in the U.S. or can it be in
It does
the
not. It could be anywhere.
There's a guy called Des Lynam.
Yeah.
Who, do you know who I mean by that?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And for anyone listening who doesn't, he's a gentleman who is, I would say in his late 60s, but I may have offended him. I may be wrong.
He won't be listening, don't worry.
Yeah. He is a man who I grew up watching, and he was the, I guess you could equate him to the Bob Costas of UK TV and sport. And he is a guy that my dad, as I was growing up, used to tell me he's the best. He's the best of the best. Why is he the best? Because he can host shows from wherever he is without a prompter, without a need to be a different person to how he is in real life. And he can cross from the very serious. He was hosting the show when the Hillsborough disaster happened back in 89. So he hosted that show brilliantly. And, of course, he wasn't expecting that to happen, and that has to be one of the hardest things ever. And then he can do the Grand National Horse Race, which is up in Liverpool once a year in the UK. And he does that without scripts, without anything, for hours on end. And he just had a way about him which made broadcasting look so simple and so classy. And I would love, amazingly, he called me up. He now writes a column for the Daily Telegraph once a month, I think. And a few years ago, I was presenting the FA Cup final. I think I was the first woman to ever do that. And that was his angle, and he wanted to do his column on that. And it sounds like a big name drop, and I don't mean to at all, but I just need to let you know that when your phone rings and Des Lynam phones you up and asks you, it's one of those moments when you think this is the wrong way around. This is 100% the wrong way around. He is a legend in television broadcasting, and I would love to sit with him and ask him about just how he does things and ask him questions that go on in my mind when I'm live on television and wonder whether he had those same things, just little kind of nuances of TV. So he would be somebody who, if I could get an evening with, I would love to, because I think he would be fascinating on the art of broadcasting.
That's very cool. I imagine that could happen, actually, if you pursued that. But that's a very cool answer, and I guarantee probably if I ask that question again of any other subject, that will be you will be the only person who gives him as an answer. So that's very cool. All right, we have spent 47 minutes with Rebecca Lowe, the Roger Moore of NBC Sports, and we appreciate her time. Rebecca, you are the third guest of this podcast. So if we make it to 10, you will be number 3 on that list. So congratulations. All right, and we will. Those of us who are EPL fans, and there are millions in this country, will be watching Rebecca on NBC Sports and NBC Sports Network throughout Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Rebecca, thank you very much for the time, and I'm sure we'll be chatting soon.
My pleasure, Richard. Thank you so much.
All right, back in the studio as we wrap up, Rebecca Lowe is fantastic. You know, writing about sports media, you ultimately want to, you know, first and foremost, you want to be accurate and fair. But in my capacity, you know, Sports Illustrated gives me the latitude to certainly have opinions on broadcasters and people and issues. And I've been writing this since the day Rebecca Lowe came here. She's a total professional. You can see her intellect and passion on the screen. It comes across here in this podcast. So that is as good a hire as NBC Sports has made, in my opinion, in the last decade. And I have said this before as well. If Rebecca Lowe replaced Bob Costas, that would be on the Olympics whenever Costas retires. That would be fantastic. And by the way, that would be my choice. Will that happen? I don't know. But if I was Mark Lazarus, the head of NBC, Rebecca Lowe is the person I would give that chair to, because I guarantee she will be totally professional and prepared if given that role. All right, I bring Bette Marston on here. So Bette, first of all, Rebecca was an excellent guest. I actually learned some things that I had no no idea about.
I'm incredibly impressed with the way that she, prepares each week.
That was amazing.
Yeah, every person has a different strategy for, preparing and getting to learn their, learn their sport and trying to, prepare for their job. And hers is just, it's incredible how regimented she is, but clearly it works for her. And
you notice that she's like particularly like, I get up at 3:25 a.m. It wasn't like I get up at 3. It was here, my clock was over 3:25. So clearly given her job schedule, She has to be on point at all these different places.
Right, yeah. And, but clearly that works for her. And, she's incredibly successful. And, I hope she doesn't stop it anytime soon.
Should we be offended that she chose Churchill over FDR? Do we pretty much expect that as a Brit?
No, come on. You expect that. She's British.
But maybe the best answer actually was not choosing either Alexei Lalas or Taylor Twellman. I feel like that is the perfect answer.
Yeah.
She might not have been able to top that. And by the way,
I hope they both hear it.
Oh, they'll trust me. I'll make sure they hear it. And for anybody who is listening, you should look up her father, who had an amazing career at the BBC. A very respected news person there. And you can tell that from him, and obviously, Rebecca's mother was an actress, so you can sort of see it's very interesting to get a sense of who her parents were and the product that you now see in Rebecca Lowe. And again, you can watch her. We're at the end of the EPL season, but she will be back at the start in 2016. And again, and I'm not just blowing smoke, this is as good a hire as NBC Sports has made this decade. All right, so we thank Rebecca Lowe for her time on the Sports Illustrated Media podcast. I, of course, always thank my producer, Bette Marston. This is Richard Deitch, and we'll be back next week on the SI Media podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.